inaugural episode of the Atomic Powered Supercast with your hosts, Andrew, David, and Jen. This week, our topic is BPRD, Plague of Frogs. And now, the cast begins.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to another greasy episode of the Atomic Powered Supercast, because we just had Carl's Jr.
Now we're eating marshmallows.
I should just say another fat episode. My name is Andy, and I'm hanging out with David.
Hey.
And Jen.
Yo.
And this week, we are kicking off our BPRD series of shows with BPRD, Plague of Frogs. I don't know when this is from, but it's by Mike Mignola, who I think did the writing for it, and Guy Davis, who did the art.
That's correct.
Where is the year on? I don't know what year this came out. Whatever.
You can Most books out. Have this page.
2003.
That's one.
2003.
I understand how to find the copyright symbol.
So that's what we read this week, and I actually think it was really cool.
Fucking amazing.
I mean, I can tell it's not Mike Mignola, right? I can tell the art isn't Mike Mignola. But Guy Davis is doing a really good Mike Mignola impression.
His art's, like, creepy in a good way.
Yeah, because when we were in Hellboy, right, we could tell that Mike Mignola was known for doing cover art. Because there were just full-page splashes everywhere in that thing. And they worked out great. They were awesome. And here, the art style is very similar. But I don't remember any full-page splash page.
No.
I don't remember them.
There wasn't
one
that, like, stood out.
But it was fine, because they still got a lot of really good creepy images. Like Abe Sapien and all the bodies coming down in the ocean. Oh my god, that was fucking freaky. That was good. So yeah, in this one, basically Sadu Hem comes back, which is... I'm glad it's Sadu Hem. It's somebody we've actually seen before in Seed of Destruction. This was...
We can make connections.
I know. This was, I didn't even do that on purpose. It's just accidental skills.
Good job. So the thing that stood out for me the most about this comic as opposed to other comics we've read in our tenure as podcasters is that this comic does a really good job of showing and not telling.
Yes.
Yes.
I loved that because it sets a good tone for the comic. Because even though this is a team comic, all these characters are very alone.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Especially once they get to Crab Point.
I really love the team dynamic here. Because they're a good team of people, but they're not like a super team in any way. They actually, when I was reading it, they reminded me of Stargate. Because if you ever seen Stargate, they're a team of really smart, really capable people that never get the job done exactly right.
So which one's MacGyver here?
Kate. I think Kate is.
Okay.
She's MacGyver?
She's just the badass with a gun running around making quippy words. Right?
Johan is definitely Daniel Jackson.
Yes, and then the,
yeah.
Roger is Teal'c, right?
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
Right? See, I mean, the similarities are there. Like, they're all very good at their job. Like, Roger's a good, beat-em-up, durable guy, right? They all fit the role just right.
You know, Abe Sapien really is Samantha, when you think about it.
Right, so they're all very good at the do, but they're maybe not quite good enough, you know? Like, at the end, they stop this plague of frogs, but Sadu Hem still got let out.
Well, there's still frogs, too.
Yeah, and there's still frogs that got out. Yeah.
And I think that's later followed up in a trade called War of Frogs. That's a little later.
Maybe, but I like how, like, you see them handle the situation, but still not entirely get it right. We're going to be munching on marshmallows the entire episode, I know.
Good marshmallows. They're, like, not stale.
So I really like that about this team, that they're good and they're fun to watch, and they make mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like when you see the Avengers, like, in the movie and in the comics, they all have their own flaws. But at the end of the comic, they didn't make any mistakes. The bad guy is beaten. Sure, there's some property damage, but there's fucking always property damage. Like, at the end of the day, with the Avengers, the job is done and done well, and goddammit, the enemy is beaten. Here, the enemy's kind of beaten, but still out there. The frogs are still loose.
They solved the immediate problem, right?
Yeah. It's just plug the hole that's there today, and then hopefully it doesn't get too bad next week.
It feels like a really good way of doing a cliffhanger where you're not like, look at me, I'm not done. You know, it feels really natural for the story to end where it did and still leave something to finish.
Like, there was an enclosed story, but there were consequences that are going to resonate in the future issues, I assume.
Well, I mean, yeah, there's frogs that are still out there. Saduham is some weird fungus monster. Like, what was the thing's name in Super God? The fungus
Morgan
monster.
Morgan Lugus.
Yeah, Morgan Lugus. Kind of reminds me of Morgan Lugus.
Yeah, I can see that.
Use spores to control people.
Yeah.
Never trust a fungus god.
Mm-mm.
Only grows on dead things.
That's why nobody ever likes to play Toad in Mario.
But Toad is the best one in Mario Supercar. Toad or Koopa?
That's a discussion for another day. I don't think we need to go into that in this comic podcast. I'm sorry I brought up Toad.
It's okay. It's relevant in two levels. Toad, frog, and fungus.
That's exactly what I was going for. Thank you, Andy.
No problem.
Which of the team members did we like the most? Or do we have, like, an equal love here?
So,
or an equal hate.
I wanted more of Roger.
Yeah. I actually went and got the thing where he first appears, because I want to know more about this fat homunculus.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm like, that is intriguing and kind of gross.
Yeah, because the closest thing he had to a family turned out to be a giant made out of human fat, and Roger had to melt him.
Ew. You know that's going to make for a good story.
And they brought him back by plugging him in, or...
That's cool, yeah.
Yeah. Apparently he needs, like, a constant power source. I kind of did some outside research because I was so intrigued by these guys. He needs a constant power source, so they equip him with a generator, and that's how he's functioning now. But if he ever dies, they can just kind of reboot him.
That's awesome.
That's useful. Yeah, so like I said, I wanted to see more Roger. It was cool to get Abe's origin, kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah, even though it's done really just vaguely.
But, I mean, you get this notion, I mean...
That he was this thing that was happy in the sea, and that somehow he was forced to merge with a man.
Well, I think the guy we see as Abe Sapien is the man.
Yeah, that's not what I understood. Like, yeah, I kind of...
Yeah, the guy we see as Abe Sapien is Call, right?
So whatever was in that thing, like... turned him into Abe Sapien.
Do you want some spoilers?
Sure.
So this society he was part of, they found the jellyfish thing and he was Call. But they thought that the jellyfish, like, they thought that him as Abe Sapien was the reincarnation of this super powerful jellyfish god thing. And I guess he wasn't. He's just a human who was, like, transformed into fishy dude. And they abandoned him on the day of Lincoln's assassination because I guess their secret occult society, like, involved Lincoln's assassins.
The Victorian submarine was pretty sweet.
Yes. And the fucking, like, the diving suit that looked like a Big Daddy.
Yes. But I'm interested because when you see Abe Sapien's spirit, right, show up in the Victorian times, there's, when he starts walking around, all of a sudden there's frogs raining from the air.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering if there's going to be some kind of circular thing involving Abe Sapien and these frog monsters.
I kind of wonder how much it's, like, just, if it's literal, like, that actually, because, you know, sometimes it does rain frogs, rarely.
Yes.
Or fish, you know, if we have weird weather. But I kind of wonder if it's meant to be, like, symbolic, like his memories are altered, or...
Could be, because in the flashback or whatever, I don't know, there's some kind of circular memory thing going on here. He's shown in the BPRD overalls, which I love that their uniform is overalls. So there's some circular memory thing going on here where he's seeing it from a future perspective.
And, like, his human self sees Abe Sapien and thinks he's some sort of demon. I liked that.
Yeah.
Because it makes me wonder, like, does Abe remember when he saw himself? Like,
well, actually,
he can't remember
anything. He can't remember his life before being woken up, right?
So I guess the question is he remembering when he saw himself? That'd be cool.
I don't know, maybe we'll get that a little bit more next week. Because next week we're reading an Abe Sapien trade. So fingers crossed. We'll see some.
I really liked that they gave us, like, one-panel explanations of all the characters who weren't Abe.
Yeah, and they were really well done, too.
Yeah, and they did the editorial thing where they're like, see, blah, blah, blah. And this time, instead of being like, hey, go away, editor, I was like, I should get those.
Yeah, because it's really simple. It's not like the editor trying to make a quirky comment.
It's that's like, here's a footnote.
Footnote, this is where it was. Footnote, this is where it was. It's just like, Hellboy, Seed of Destruction. Footnote, you know. And I really like the way Liz is done in here, too. And I really like Liz as a character. Mm-hmm. Like, give somebody control of fire, and then make her a pyromaniac. So that, yes, she has a super useful, incredibly strong ability that you never want her to use. Ever. Because there's a couple times in there where we have to be like, rein it in, rein it in.
Yep.
And then when it's useful, blowing out the skeletons is like, holy fuck, I was in the middle of that. You couldn't have waited 2 seconds? And she's like, I said run.
Sorry, what's the blonde lady's name?
Kate.
Kate. I keep wanting to call her Katie. I guess the same difference.
Hmm.
I wish they had given more of her background. Like, they only talk about it a little, but I guess she actually used to be an NYU professor for folklore.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and she just, like, wrote some books, and then they recruited her as a consultant. And I guess this is her first, like, appearance as a regular cast member.
Like, actually going out on a mission?
Yeah, I think she makes a... She says something
when she's fighting the skeleton, yeah. She's like, Hellboy said to be fun. Hellboy said to get out in the field. Enjoy field work. She's like, fuck this. I miss my desk.
But it was boring. I like that, too. She's like, I could go back to normal life, but it's so boring, so I'm going to do this instead.
Blasting and
she's
fungus
pretty,
infested.
She's pretty badass, too. Like, she she handles herself in the being attacked by glowing skeletons pretty well.
But I like how she's in the middle of the graveyard, and then she starts to hear a rumble, and she's like, why the fuck am I here? Of all places to be during the middle of paranormal shit, why am I in the middle of a graveyard? I like how she doesn't think of it, but then when it happens, you get that moment where you know you would think that too.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you're just looking around for clues or whatever, wandering around this town, trying to pick some information out of whatever's laying around, you might just lose track of where you are. But then as soon as you hear that noise, you know you're going to have that realization, holy fuck, why wasn't I paying attention to this?
You know, I really like Johan in this. Mostly because he's like, well, I'd dissipate if I was left out long enough. But luckily, I found this dead dog.
Yeah.
I mean, how so must Abe feel if there's, like, a dead dog sitting there talking to him?
In the middle of a burning forest.
Yeah, in the middle of a burning forest. And it's not just, like, talking. It's also reaching out with, like, ectoplasm and, like, plugging his little spear hole.
See, but that's... I think that scene perfectly encompasses why I really like this comic book. It's because we get there, and at no point in the path to getting there do I have to question my suspension of disbelief.
Yes.
Like, it's all done so... That moment is so random and weird, and it's a fish man laying in the middle of a forest that was lit on fire by a pyrokinetic whatever, talking to a dead dog inhabited in, like, what the there's so many things here that need suspension of disbelief, and it all works together.
Mm-hmm. I feel like that's where Mignola's strength as a writer is, too. Like, he makes a horror comic that's, like, it's intriguing in its horror. It's not horrifying. But it's also really humorous in a lot of ways. Because you look at these things, and you take them out of the story, and they're kind of laughable. But in a good way.
Yeah.
Hence the humor.
But I think what makes it work is the comic and the characters and everything just take the existence of this stuff for fact.
Yeah.
And it never explains it to you. Like what David said earlier, there's a whole lot of show don't tell in here, which works to its benefit. Like, we don't need to explain what these frog monsters are. We don't need to explain where they came from. The point is they're fucking frog monsters and they're evil. And you need to beat them.
Yeah, I mean, you could pick this thing apart and be like, why is the fungus monster making frogs out of people, right? There's no logical line between all those different things. But it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter in this comic. And that's what makes it work so well. You don't get hung up on things like that.
Yeah.
So, I also kind of like Abe. I want to talk about Abe, how even after he has this dream about this past that he can't reconcile, right? And they go out on the mission. And I don't know if it's a defense mechanism or if he's true when they're like, Abe, you need to snap out of it. And he's like, I'm not thinking about my dream. I'm thinking about Roger.
Oh, yeah.
I'm concerned about Roger. I liked that moment because I honestly couldn't tell if he was saying that purely in a defensive sort of way or if he legitimately was concerned about Roger. Because I don't see Abe being so self-concerned. I think he's taken aback.
He's really stoic. Like, even when he sees the ghost of Rasputin, he stabbed Rasputin in Seat of Destruction, yeah. Right? Yeah.
Stabbed him with a spear the same way he just got stabbed.
And he's just like, ah, fuck. Get out of here. Like, he's so very stoic, and that makes me think he's genuine in his concern about Roger. Or, like, even when he wakes up in the ambulance and he's like, what happened? And he goes, where's Roger, right?
Yeah.
Also, I think some background might help here. Although, I don't want to give people, like, huge spoilers. But at some point, they end up with Roger. Before he's actually on the team, he's incapacitated. And BPRD, like, the guys in charge, want to dissect him. Because, you know, he's a homunculus. And Abe steps in and is like, no, you can't do that. So, I think maybe his concern is genuine.
Well, and they probably,
I was going to say, there's probably, like, a kinship between them. Because both of them were found abandoned.
That's exactly what I was just going to say. Oh. Well, because you get the flashback with Abe, right? And Abe's laying there in a tube.
Yeah, yeah. Right, that's the last panel. Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. After he...
But yeah, but then in
after Roger's found.
Yeah, and then in the flashbacks, right? In the flashbacks we get Liz describing, we know this person's backstory, this person's backstory, how do we find Roger? We find Roger laying there on a table, unconscious. Laying on a table, laying in a tube, unconscious, and woken up, you know? Like, they have this sort of weird kinship, and they're both stoic characters.
And, like I said earlier, I wish we had gotten more about Roger, but I think what's so great is what we do know about him is so intriguing. Like, the way that they describe Roger at the very beginning as having a childlike... What does it say? I have to find it again. Something like a childlike glee for life. Maybe it was in the beginning of the book.
Maybe.
It might not have actually been in the comic.
I don't remember reading that.
I really did like the beginning when we were first introduced to BPRD in this.
It says, it's in the trade I have. He has a little, quick little, like, three-sentence bios of everybody, and it describes Roger as a homunculus made from human blood and herbs discovered in Romania. Roger was first brought to life by Liz's pyrokinetic touch. Whether or not he's actually alive may be up for debate, but his childlike love of that life is not.
Aww.
And so I thought that was, like, a really good intro to him. And so and it's interesting because when I first read that he had a childlike love, I kind of thought that, oh, he's like, he has a childlike mind, but that's not the case.
Well, notice his dream. Like, he's kind of, he wavers between being very complex and being kind of like Drax when we first see him in Annihilation Prologue. Because the dream he has, he's like a little boy and he chases a ball out and gets hit by lightning. And the way he describes it is not detailed. It's very basic, the way a child would describe a nightmare. Later in, when, like, he's in that, like, a shipping warehouse or something, he sees the little girl, right? And he's like, hey, you, do you need help? And he never speaks, like, in complex sentences. So,
but you can tell there are complex thoughts in there. I mean, that dream is full of complex thoughts.
Yeah.
Like, where did I come from? Why am I here? You know, I have consciousness, but I don't have family. That you dream, can tell there's a deeper mind in there, even if you can't verbalize it that way.
The dream was really cool, I thought, too, because it's like, it's if you don't know who he is, it sets him up as, like, maybe having a past where he's a child, and you wonder, how did he become this thing? And then later you realize it's imagined, because he never even had that.
So one of the other things I really like about this, like, get you into the characters right away, is I think it's in the first one. I really like how they, like, all live together. Isn't that in the second one? Oh, yeah, it's in the first one.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the house where they're all kind of waking up in the morning together.
And they seem so normal. Like, Amy's making comments about how everybody's sad or tired because nobody's had their coffee yet.
Yeah. But then Johan's just sitting there like, I don't need sleep. I have very little physical form. He's just like, and Johan, they're all coming out slowly. And the first thing you see is Johan just sitting at the table. And he has no expression because he doesn't have a face. And he's just like sitting there. And everybody walks in the room and he's still just sitting there the exact same way. And it's like, Johan, you're so creepy. Move a little bit.
Yeah, he really is Daniel Jackson. Like, now that you've said that, I can't dismiss the idea.
But I also like, in these pages, when we first see Roger, he's sitting, like, in the library with this giant-ass tome just labeled Roman Gods. And he's just, like, reading through it like he would read through a dictionary or something. I get the sense he's just like, okay, these are words. I want to read words. But I don't think Kate's in these scenes, is she? Oh,
yeah, she comes in. Yeah. She's like, mission time.
Yeah. See, that's why she's the MacGyver. She comes in, briefs him. Mission time, guys. Let's go. Get to the chopper.
Yep.
And also, I want to say this is something that doesn't happen very much in comics, but I love how this one has the transition panel. Even if it is just a scene of a chopper flying over somewhere.
Going whoop, whoop, whoop.
Yeah, that's fine, but it's just, it's good because it helps me.
Like, here's how they moved.
Well, yeah, there's so much in comics about what you fill in between the panels, right? Like, the primary, the thing they talk about a lot in comics today is the power of the gutter and that kind of thing. Like, moving from one scene to the next is all done in the mind, and so the real value of comics is what your mind puts together between the panels. But sometimes those breaks are really big. Like, if you jump cities, or if you jump states, sometimes you jump continents, like, it's big gaps that your brain has to fill in that sort of break up the flow of the story. And it's not that hard to put in one little transition, a picture of a chopper. Okay, it's mission time. Get the crew together. Here's a chopper. Now we're at our position. You know? Not mission time. All of a sudden we're in Arabia. You know? It's like, that's a big jump. And just that one little, it's the little things like that, I think, that make this comic really good. And even, like, when they're viewing the camera feed, the next page over, there's just, like, one little small blank panel that just shows the camera going dead.
Yeah, it's like a little bit of static.
Yeah. Just the little things like that help carry the flow of this comic very naturally.
Mm-hmm. You know, they actually use a transition device really well here, and it's the black panel. A lot of comics use it when, like, a character passes out and things fade to black. But here, things start black and then fade into reality. And I thought, like, that's a really clever way of doing things. Especially in Abe's dreams, it starts black, and then we, like, get more blue and we see he's in the ocean.
Yeah, it's kind of like he's waking up into his dream sort of a thing. And I gotta say, the art in this is really, really good. I mean, we're talking about panels and stuff, but the art is just solid throughout.
Yeah. It's stylized, but it looks... Well, I mean, it's stylized, but it's very constant in, you know, how things and people are portrayed, and it's a good kind of style. In fact, actually, in the individual issues that I have here, there's a reader letter in the back of one of them that just basically says, like, yeah, the guy who does his art, Guy Davis, right?
Yeah, Guy Davis.
Guy Davis is creepy. Oh, wait, I mean, his art is really creepy. It's good, though.
Well, I think that's a challenge, right? Is like, sometimes it's good to see art styles that are a departure from the norm as far mm-hmm. as comics go, but it's real easy for artists or creators to make, like, art that's too abstract or almost incomprehensible. And this does a good job of not moving into that realm of too abstract. Like, I mean, that's fine and sometimes... But, like, for when we read Arkham Asylum, that was a big problem for me.
Yeah, me too.
The art was good. I'm not saying it was bad art. But it didn't... I don't think it worked well as a comic. Or for comics.
Yeah, Dave McKean is really a lot more interpretive.
And it's fine. Like, I'm not knocking him as an artist. I'm just, like I said, I just don't think that that is good comic book art. At least from my perspective.
Sometimes when you over-stylize, then you get divisive with your audience, you know? It's like, either you like the style or you don't like the style. And if you don't like the style, then you're not going to read it. And it's just like, it doesn't have to be that way. You can have strong, strong style and not be divisive. Like, this is really strong style, but it's really good.
Like, another artist that's like that is John Romita Jr. I know there's a lot of people that don't like his art, and sometimes I don't, but I think his is a good comic. It works in comics, you know?
Yeah.
I feel like this art is a more underground version of Amanda Connors. And it kind of does this thing. Like, it's sketchier, right? There's more of a sketch to it in the line art. It does a thing that she does, though, where if you zoom out from a character, you just get the dots for the eyes. And I really like that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I remember that from, like, The Pro.
Yeah. And to me, that always tells me, like, the artist has shown me a character, and they, like...
They rely on you to remember
that character. Yeah, they know that I can remember what their drawing looks like. I also like how Guy Davis... Like, all of these characters, although they're cartoony, they look real, and I can picture them as real people. Like, the Liz Sherman I picture looks nothing like the one from the movie. But she's... I can have a view of her in my mind as, like, a definite real human being. Whereas, I don't know, you look at pretty much any Marvel or DC woman, and it's like,
same face for all of them.
If you did some work here, there, and there, and put on, like, a spandex bodysuit and a bunch of Photoshop, then I can picture it.
But it's just, yeah, here these characters all have a definite facial structure. Like, Liz has a long face.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Kate has a very sort of boxy kind of face. And these are general shapes, but they're consistent shapes that give them identity beyond woman in a comic. You know? Because all the guys in here, none of the guys in here are humans. You know? So you don't need that sort of identity with any of them. But that's fine, because most of the time there's not a problem with identity with guys in comics, but there is with women. And here, they all have certain set identity.
Like, Kate really looks like a middle-aged professorial woman. Like, she's not super youthful, and you can kind of see, like, her facial features are older than, like, someone in their mid-20s, but she's not a trope for, like, an old woman by any means. She looks like a person.
I also like the way this comic book's art really challenges what I was expecting out of a horror comic. Like, when we read Seed of Destruction, Mike Mignola gave me almost exactly what I was expecting in the stylized art. A lot of dark colors, a lot of blacks, a lot of shadows. In a horror comic, that's what you expect, right? Things creeping out of the shadows. But here, Guy Davis has a style that feels a lot like Mike Mignola's would. It feels like it fits in with that sort of vibe. But Guy Davis uses a lot of really strong colors. Like, the skeletons on fire, or the skeletons that are possessed, right? That's a really strong, bright green.
Yeah.
The red is really bright. And Guy Davis is not afraid to fill a page with orange and red. He's not afraid to fill a page with green. In the middle of a horror comic, to have these bright pages, and even, like, the dull blue... He uses some really bright blues when Abe Sapien's remembering what it's like being underground. Like, he's not afraid to use these incredibly bright colors in his stylized horror comic.
You know what's cool, too? He has a lot of, like, detail in the depth of color. I was flipping through and I saw Liz Sherman's hair. And normally, female comic characters either have, like, really, really red hair, really brown hair, really blonde hair, or white hair, right? And Liz Sherman has, like, this brownish-red hair that is completely, like, a normal natural color, but that you don't see in comics.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks really, like, real Auburn hair. That's the color it would be. And it's bright, but at the same time, because it's so natural-looking, it doesn't call attention to itself.
Yeah, see, that's another good page, David.
Oh, well, the reason I flipped to this page is when you're talking about the differences between Mignola and Davis's art... I remembered this, and I thought, you know, the parts where Abe is having his flashbacks to Seed of Destruction, And it's the shots of Rasputin where he's impaled with the spear. It looks a lot like Mignola's art. So that's kind of a cool thing to do. It's like,
yeah.
That's how, when I think about that scene in the comic, I remember it in Mignola's art. So maybe Abe remembers it that way too. That's kind of a cool thing. And I just thought that was interesting.
Yeah, no, it's really
good. Because it uses the heavy blacks and reds that Mignola does. But then it switches back to Guy Davis' style. It's just a neat transition.
So, how do we clear this up? The guy that was Sadhu Hem's, like, preacher, right? Were we supposed to recognize him?
No.
Okay.
He's not a character from Seed of Destruction, if that's what you mean.
Okay, because it seems like Abe recognized him from somewhere.
Yeah, he does. Abe recognizes him from within this comic.
Okay.
Because there's a part where Abe's, before Abe finds the little shrine to Rasputin,
yeah.
He's looking at these newspaper clippings.
Oh, yeah.
And it says the Miracle Boy, right? Okay. The Miracle Boy, the old man, is that boy. That's what Abe's talking about.
That's really cool.
See, look, Abe says, you're him, the West Virginia Miracle Boy. And that's what.
So the old man isn't the guy who was in the lab earlier talking about Sadhu Hem?
No, the guy that was in the lab is Sadhu Hem. The fungus monster is the guy from the lab. The guy who broke into the lab and killed the other doctor.
No, not the guy who, the one that, like, when they're talking about it, the guy who says, you should have killed him, I told you to kill him.
No, that's just a BPRD.
Crazy BPRD guy? That's
a BPRD scientist.
Okay. I was a little confused because they look kind of similar.
Yeah, they do. They have different beards, though. Come on, Andy.
My bad.
In fact, I don't think the preacher has a beard. Oh, no. No, that's the scientist has a beard.
But the scientist has, like, a... The preacher totally has a beard. Where's the preacher?
Okay, I don't remember. I'm going to go look now.
Totes bearded.
Oh, please don't.
Let's see.
Oh, yeah, he has a different... But his beard's white.
Yeah.
Anyways.
Hair color changes. Yeah. It's all in the hair color.
Yeah. Totally. I won't sink to your level and use that.
Slime. I don't know what to talk about. This is a really good comic.
Yeah. I think it's easier to talk about it when you have, like, some things to praise and some things to criticize, but I honestly don't have any complaints.
Yeah, this is just, like, a really... It's well put together, and it flows really nicely, and... It doesn't really leave any loose ends, but it gives you enough little tidbits that you makes me want to go read the next in the series. So,
yeah. Like, I really want to go out and buy the big, beautiful hardcover.
Yeah, and the price was pretty good.
I'd really like to do that as well.
Yeah, because the big hardcover, like, that's the other thing. Dark Horse is really good at pricing their comics. That big, beautiful hardcover is only $35 for, like, 408 pages of good comics.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really excited because... When the preacher guy is saying, we've already run, like, it's really ominous. I was like, they will be drawn to the secret places of the frog monsters. They will remember the old songs, and they will sing and pray prayers not heard in a million years on this earth, and the old gods will wake. I'm like, oh, shit. There's, like, this weird-ass temple shrine made of skulls and intestines, and, like, it's freaky and ominous.
Mignola does a really good job of taking random, like, bullshit words that sound arcane and making them sound,
like,
very dire.
Abdur Jahad.
Yeah.
Sadhu Hem.
Oh god.
And, like, the babbling kind of language that they use.
Yeah.
He's really good at coming up with these, like, sort of false languages.
Actually, I think it's kind of worth talking about our responses to seeing, like, the footnotes and wanting to buy things. Like, you know, it's getting harder and harder for paper comics publishers, not digital's picking up, you know, but to make readers want to buy more and more, they often do gimmicky things. Like, for instance, right before Avengers versus X-Men came out, like, it turned out okay, but everyone right before was like, oh god, it's going to be so gimmicky, it's going to be so filled with crap.
I think everybody's getting flashbacks of things like Marvel versus DC.
Yeah. And the thing is, like, this manages to rope you in and get you to, like, want to buy their other products without ever pulling off a gimmick. And that's good writing. Because, I mean, we've read good things. and we've said, like, Kraven's Last Hunt, right? But that's not going to make me pick up more Spider-Man.
Yeah.
I feel like it was self-contained. But since this is mostly, like, creator-done, I think Mike Mignola's written all of the Hellboy and BPRD, right?
I think
right?
so. Almost all of it, if not all of it.
It's like, I trust it to quality. You know, I think it's all going to be really good.
And I think it also comes down to... It's a combination of all of it. It's a good job of a show don't tell, right? So you see everything that you need for the story, but not everything you need to know to set your curiosity. You know, I've seen Abe have this flashback circular memory thing with his origin, but I don't know what that fish god is, that jellyfish
yeah.
thing.
Yeah.
I don't know what that is. I don't know how Abe is interpreting this existence that he's remembering. I don't know, but I want to know. I like Abe, and I want to know all that kind of stuff.
The best part, though, is it's not relevant to the story. Like,
yeah, it remains self-contained, even though there's sort of remnants coming up before and after.
If I read a thing, and I don't know who Wolverine is, that's going to be, like, a huge negative impact on my reading experience. If I read this, and I don't know what sort of jellyfish god Abe Sapien spawned from, that's okay, because it actually doesn't impact the story. It's a wider universe that allows you to enjoy it in pieces without forcing itself on you. And I think that's something very difficult to do, but very elegant here.
Yeah. And it's also the way the team sort of comes at things, right? Because as a reader, you want to attack the... You attack the story from the point of view of the team. And the team's point of view is, all I need to know is enough to figure out how to kill this. Right? They just want to do enough to plug the immediate leak, like we were saying earlier. They just want to stop what's happening right now. Solve the immediate problem. If a bigger problem comes up later, we will solve that then. Right now, this town is overrun, and there's going to be a plague of frogs, and we need to stop that as much as we can now. So, yeah, there's all this stuff with Saruhen sort of here, there. We don't know everything about Saruhen. There's stuff with Abe here, there, back and forth, but they're not the immediate problems. We don't need to solve that today. I don't know. Are we done talking about this one? It's hard. It's always hard to talk about the really good ones because you just gush about it for days and days.
Yeah.
And it feels repetitive.
What I'm doing right now that is distracting me so badly is I am going through eBay. Guy Davis is an eBay seller as well.
Oh, really?
He sells his own original art.
Oh,
so
cool.
I'm looking for him and looking for something of his to put on my wall because I like it. I really like him.
It's good art.
It's probably... Good time to rate this thing.
Yeah, if we're getting distracted. What do you got, David?
Making
you go first
hard.
Since last week you made me go first.
I'm going to give this... Maybe this is a little bit... this is hard. I'm going to go with a 4.5. It's just really hard to give something a 5. 5 just seems too hard. But that doesn't seem right either, because we just sat and gushed about this, and I can't really think of anything that is negative. Like... Maybe it should be longer? I don't know. Just, like, pulling for things. Like we talked about for the last 45 minutes or whatever. It's just a really good comic. I think I said it before. This is just a nice... It's solid, you know? There's not anything to complain about it. Art's really good. The story is, you know, engrossing and interesting and different and gives you just a little bit... It just gives you just enough that you're going to want to come back and read more BPRD comics. And, I mean, I want to read them just because I want to know more about Roger.
Yeah.
But, and then there was enough about Abe's origin that you feel like you have a working knowledge of what happened, but you don't have the complete picture, so got to read more. So you got to know, find out what happened to Abe, where he came from. So... I feel like 4.5's a fitting score, because I feel like Comic Cast would be pretty stellar to get a 5.
To get a 5. Okay.
But, yeah.
Jen?
I'm waffling between a 4 and a 5, which I guess puts it at a 4.5 as well. Just copying everyone's ratings for these past episodes. But it's really good. I enjoyed it. I immediately decided I'd go out, like, pick up more, read more of this series. I want to see it. I'm trying to buy art from the artists, but it doesn't have that, like, je ne sais quoi of a 5. I don't know what makes a 5.
Busting out the French words, huh?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Academic up in here, right? But it doesn't have that thing, that, you know, unspeakable quality that's just like, oh, that was so good. My life is complete now that I've read it. Like, actually, you know, that's, I think this is the difference. I feel like my life is incomplete because I haven't read the whole series. Whereas if I pick up a 5 work, like Craven's Last Hunt, I was like, that added something to my existence that I didn't know was needed, but now I realize was so necessary. And it's like there's a sense of completeness in it and wanting to read it. I don't know if that makes any sense, but that's why this is a 4.5 and not a 5.
That's fair. I'm going to give it a 5.
Okay.
Just because I really like the team. Outlier. I think the art is phenomenal, and I really like the way that Mike Mignola goes after a character. He does it in a really subtle, slow, natural way. You know, like, I don't know anybody that I meet and talk to, and the first thing that comes up is their quote-unquote origin story, right? Like, you know, like, my first conversation with you, David, was not, so, start your life from the beginning, tell me now. You know? That's not natural, that doesn't happen. But I'm looking at this page where Liz is saying, we know where everybody came from. We know Roger came from here. We know Johan came from here. We know I came from here. But the only thing we don't know about is you. And we get this quick flashback memory of Abe and Atub and just Liz giving him sort of like a sidelong look. Like, I trust you. You know, you're the leader of our team, but I don't know. And this not knowing kind of makes a little bit of uneasiness whenever this kind of thing comes up. And it's not something, and then you get another panel of Abe looking back at her, just straight. Like, not wanting to say a word, that sort of stoicism that you brought up earlier, Jen. And I really like the characters have their own personality and how Mignola lets the character dominate how these characters come out. And doesn't let the way the reader wants to read the story dominate how the story is told. The characters dominate the story, not the reader. And I like that dictation going that way instead of the other way, like it happens with so many other comics. And this is a fun comic to read, and we talk about how it's a contained story, yet it has, you know, threads coming out from the beginning and from the end, and how that makes you want to read more and pick up more. But I like the way that the characters are done, and I think that's the strength of this comic, whereas so many others have it as a weakness. So that's why I want to give this one a 5. I mean, aside from phenomenal art and a really fun story and all the other great things we've talked about, I think the characters just are what do it for me. Because it's just so naturally portrayed. 5. Boom. Did it. Done.
Sounds good.
So next week we're going to read a trade paperback called Abe Sapien, The Devil Does Not Jest in Other Stories. And by other stories, they mean just one. So it collects...
Well, other story doesn't sound that good.
It collects the two issues called Abyssal Plane, number 1 and 2. It's from 2010. And then the other one, The Devil Does Not Jest, is actually from 2011, last year, which is issues 1 and 2. So it's just two-issue miniseries, just quick little series. And this is actually the second volume of Abe Sapien. This is where we come up with Dark Horse's weird branding, titling kind of thing. If they'd have just all labeled it under BPRD, maybe it'd be simpler. I don't know. But it's Abyssal Plane 1 and 2, and The Devil Does Not Jest 1 and 2. And that's
there was an Abe Sapien standalone title, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah, and I think it's these.
Yeah.
But it's just, it's weird. Anyway, so that's next week. Until then, if you want to look up the exact issues or find the trade on Amazon, which we always link to, you can do that on our website, which is www.atomicpoweredsupercast.com. You can always also ask us directly on Twitter,
which is www.twitter.com/APSupercast or at APSupercast.
See, I've been keeping consistent. When I switch it up, you guys get confused.
It's so hard.
You can also email us at
AtomicPoweredSupercast@gmail.com.
See, but David's got it locked in. He came in today worried, like, I'm going to say APSupercast.com again. I know I'm going to do it, but he's on his game now. And as always, please subscribe to us on iTunes. All right. I'm excited we did BPRD. This is looking really good.
Excellent.
I'm excited to do more.
Me too.
All right. So until next week.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.